We hope you will join in our roundtable discussion this hour on bridging the racial and social gap in Wisconsin, primarily between African Americans and whites. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our conversation comes out of a town hall meeting in Madison last month where community leaders and citizens came together to talk about how we can have a better dialogue about race issues, and we decided we should extend the conversation statewide. As we know, there have been many reports condemning Wisconsin for having such high racial disparities in education, employment, incarceration. Wisconsin has been called the worst state in the nation for African American children. And we're talking about what's standing in the way of our communicating and understanding what's going on here. We welcome your input at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We will hear the thoughts of five different guests this hour: African-American men and women who live in different parts of the state. We'll talk with them about their experiences living in Wisconsin and their thoughts on improving relationships between blacks and whites and improving the dialogue that we can all have. Our first guest is Gloria Ladson Billings, professor of urban education, curriculum and instruction, and education policy studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us. You know, at last month's Together Apart discussion that was held, you said that the only way useful conversations about race can take place is if both groups see each other as fully human. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that there is this perception that African Americans are somehow less than. This goes back all the way back to our sciences, psychology, anthropology, that, you know, creates this hierarchy or scale in the 19th century, literally at the world expositions, you'd see these hierarchies of races and suggesting that African Americans were among the lowest. And I think that that mentality, although not explicit, is still, there is a residual from that.
Yeah. A woman at that panel said something along the lines of, well, I know how to work for organizations to help African Americans who are, you know, in dire circumstances, but I don't know how to talk to you.
And that was a point that I made, that I'd been in a relationship where we were doing some work together, and there was a white woman working with me who was extremely uncomfortable. And so I finally called her and I said, "What's the problem?" And she says, "Well, I'm used to being in situations where I'm helping black people. I don't know what it's like to work with somebody who's my peer." And for me, that is the crux of the issue. People want to help because they think that what they're doing is charity. But to have an equal status relationship, that is to have people who come to your home, that you socialize with, that you have more than a surface relationship, is where the hard work is. And I think I also made a point that I'd gone to a neighbor's funeral, and he was more than 80 years old. And I noted to my husband, I said, "We're the only black people in here. You mean someone can live 80-plus years and only know two black people?"
Yeah. Well, so talk some more about that. What will it take for this fully human understanding to come about?
Well, again, I think we have to have better peer relationships. We have to have those experiences where, you know, you have two students, not a university student helping some homeless person. You have to have two pastors. You have to have two physicians who literally sit down and have conversations about their experiences.
Yeah. You also talked at that town hall meeting about the concept of microaggressions that one person can enact on another. what kinds of things count as microaggressions when it comes to race?
So microaggressions are like the everyday, ordinary experiences that you have when someone, you know, you're waiting in a line, you're the next person, but they don't wait on you. They wait on someone behind you who happens to be white. Or you go into a department store, and it's clear that the loss prevention manager is following you. Or you are in that same store, and you ask to look at an item, and maybe it's an expensive item, but what you get from the sales associate is, well, you know this is very expensive, as if to say, you're too stupid to know that it's cost a lot, and that you certainly couldn't afford it. So it's those tiny things. And I think what happens in the society is we get all riled up around things like Donald Sterling. I mean, this is a millionaire man who may indeed be suffering dementia, although I'm not a physician, so I can't say that for sure. But that becomes the rallying cry when what really people are impacted by is the everydayness of racism.
Yeah. You know, Robin Cherry, my producer, told me I could share this. She said that one of these microaggressions happened to her just this past week. She is African-American, was at a grocery store, I believe, at the counter, and waiting to be served, and was waiting to be served and waiting. And then a white woman walked up, and the clerk immediately went to the white woman to ask if she needed any help. So that's what she, I mean, why is this, why does that happen?
I mean, I think there are a multitude of reasons why it happens, and those reasons are both sociological, and what we're starting to find out is that they're also cognitive. There was a study that looked at what happens to the brain of white people when they encounter black people, and I don't have the authors at my fingertips, but I do know that the process was putting people in MRI, showing them images of different people, and looking at the way in which the brain functions when it saw a black face. And what the study basically said was there's what they would call almost a racial brain freeze. There is that hesitation. There is that moment that, oh, it's a black person. So I can't tell you why everyone does what they do, but mm-hmm. I can tell you that we have a long history of it. And very much a pattern of our society.
Well, how do you see microaggressions in your own life here in Madison?
Of course. And even though, you know, I've been on faculty for 22 years, I have an endowed professorship. One thing people need to realize, I'm actually the first African-American woman to earn tenure in the School of Education.
I didn't know that.
And people will celebrate that. And I say, that's not, you shouldn't be proud of that. The school's been here since 1858. You should be embarrassed that it's taken the School of Education this long. But while people will laud me in the building, I have had instances where I've gone to the parking lot and been called the N-word by a group of students driving by.
Yeah, and I think there's a belief maybe here in so-called liberal Madison that this doesn't happen, but it does happen, and it happens often?
It does. I mean, from the very moment that my family arrived, I remember the realtor was taking us to look at housing, and I was very clear that I wanted to live within the Madison city limits. I didn't want to live in the suburbs. And so he kept taking us from the east side to the west side, east side to the west side. And I said to him, I said, well, you know, it's interesting you haven't shown us anything on the south side. And the reason I knew about the south side is because of my various visits to Madison, I had attended church on the south side. And he said to me, there is no south side.
And so that means that it's just not being acknowledged?
Right. Yeah. Right. And that, and I guess the implication was, well, if you're going to be a university professor, you don't want to live over there. But there's also the sense that there's some of us who are seen as special because we have enough status, so we have the right degrees, and so we are being afforded a sort of honorary status that doesn't put us with, quote, the rest of them.
We have a caller that I'd like to bring in, Eric in Endeavor. Hello, Eric.
Good morning. I have a quick question. I just tuned in, but I heard your guest say that if people's brains are kind of hardwired to automatically see a black face and hesitate and go, oh, there's a black person. And so how are people faulted for quote-unquote microaggressions, if that's the case, briefly?
Well, is there anything we can do about microaggressions, Gloria?
Well, I think that I didn't say that it was hardwired. I said that that's what we're seeing. It doesn't mean that we couldn't have social arrangements that made it less a challenge for people. Clearly, when I was in South Africa, what struck me is how intimate black-white relations were, and that you were always, you know, white people, because of the incredible numbers of black people in South Africa, white people seemed very comfortable. And that's also one of the things that we talk about in this country. I think the narrative of this country is that, oh, the South was a bad place and we were these sort of noble people of the North. But what we do know in the South is that there was a kind of intimacy because black people worked in the homes of white people. They saw them all the time. When I travel the state, it's very clear that I'm seen as something strange. Where did you come from?
There's a listener on Facebook who says, I try not to be pessimistic, but we seem to be going high speed in the wrong direction when it comes to racism. How do you see it, Gloria?
Well, I think that there is, you know, Americans are really notorious for wanting to do things. And what I mean by that is we like to do something and be done with it. We don't like the notion of off, you know, revisiting anything. I mean, if you talk to an American about, oh, would you like to go to Europe this summer? They say, oh, no, we did Europe last year. I mean, we do things. So one of the things that we think we've done is we think we've done race. And our proof is the election of President Obama. But I would venture to say that things have gotten worse because people hide behind the notion of, well, how can we be racist? We have a black president. I would note that most people who say that to me are people who didn't vote for him, so I think that's sort of interesting. Mm-hmm. But we have this notion that we're done with this, and we don't want to keep talking about it, and we don't want to bring it back up, but we're not done with it. This is a problem of our making as a nation, and it will not be unmade in short order.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. I hope that we can talk with you again about these issues and others as we go along. Thanks a lot.
All right. My pleasure.
Gloria Ladson Billings is our guest, and we will hear from many others as we go along. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We will talk with five different guests this hour, African-American men and women who live in different parts of the state. We are going to hear about their experiences living in Wisconsin and their thoughts on improving relationships between blacks and whites in our communities. And we would like to hear from you too. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our next guest. Sheree Davis is an African-American woman living in Waupun. She works for an organization that supports individuals with intellectual disabilities. Good morning, Sheree.
Good morning, Joy.
Sheree, you were one of the reasons why we decided to do this program. When you called in last month when we were talking about bridging the social and racial divide in this state, you mentioned that in Waupun, Wisconsin, you have been mistaken for someone who must be there to visit someone at the Waupun prison. And that just,
among other things, yes.
Yeah, that just it just really opened my eyes, and I thought we should talk to you more about what it's like for you living in Wisconsin. And we had some listeners who heard that too and said, please have Sheree on to talk more about what it's like to live in Wisconsin for her, and we thought we would talk to many others too. Give us a little bit of your story of how did you end up in Waupun, Wisconsin?
Well, I ended up in Waupun, Wisconsin, because I was in a relationship with a gentleman for off and on for 9 years, and he was from Waupun. He is of Dutch origin, so we were an interracial couple. I had always heard storied, things about the North and how it's better than the South. And being from Florida, I said, well, this is a great educational opportunity for my children. And so we came up here with that thought, and I have to say I was unpleasantly surprised by the lack of diversity, the ignorance that goes through. And ignorance isn't meant to be an insulting word. It's almost really more informative, because when you don't know something, then you can't change it. So because there's a lack of diversity in this area, the only time that people really get to interact with people of color is either at the prison or if they see something on the news. And unfortunately, when you only have that perspective, when I walked into this town, the first thought was, oh, you must be here to support someone in the prison. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I have no clue. So, and then, for some people, they wanted to have more understanding. And for other people, then apparently I wasn't here for anything good. And that was it. It was the end of the conversation. And some people chose not to get to know me. And other people definitely took the time, and it was definitely well worth it.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that among other things, when I said when they had the mistaken you for someone who's visiting somebody at the prison. What other things?
Well, the first thing is, my daughter goes to a private school that I love, but she's forced to go there because she can't go to the public school. And it's not because she was thrown out. It was because of so many incidents of racism and discrimination. There's a devaluing that I feel here because of things that have happened and lack of acknowledgement. So when I mean among other things, for instance, like when my two daughters were having so much trouble in school with racism and discrimination and being bullied, the response was to move my children, not to try to improve the system. And I literally have a letter from the school board saying, yes, we agree your child's been discriminated against. Yes, we agree she's been a victim of racism and bullying, but nothing's going to change overnight. Mm-hmm. So how can you not feel devalued as a person in this community when you contribute taxes, when you have jobs in the community, when you spend your money in the community, but you don't feel that your community cares enough about you to make sure that you're comfortable, mm-hmm. to make sure that you feel equal among everyone else? And unfortunately, that takes not place all the time, but it does take place here in Waupun.
Yeah. How do you think Waupun lacking diversity can become a better place?
I think it can, but I think it would take a community effort. And that's something that I've been really trying to work on with my school. That was something that was really important to me, that my daughter be able to go to the school. Some people have a receptive ear, and some people in power do not have a receptive ear. And unfortunately, when the people in power are outweighed and they don't want to do anything, nothing happens. And that's just the truth. I've had many great dialogues with city councilmen, with the mayor, with the city administrator, with the school board members, been to many meetings. And there's a sympathy there, but the lack of empathy, the ability to not empathize is what's frustrating. Because, when you have a news channel saying racism doesn't exist and it's only being overblown, and then you have me, one person in this town, saying, excuse me, mm-hmm. that's actually not the case, and there really is a lot of it going on, and can we please work on it? It's easier to dismiss it as not true than it is to have the uncomfortable discussion about it. So, you know, and when you're a minority, unfortunately, you know, you can yell all you want. Some people will hear you, but it takes a lot more for there to be action, unfortunately.
Get a caller in for you, Jerry in Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
You know, I have agreed with the previous caller about her experiences as a black woman in Madison. I live in Milwaukee, but I'll say this. You know, and I've had this conversation with you before, Joy, about different subjects regarding race. You know, it's not only segregated. There's apartheid in the state of Wisconsin. And apartheid is different. You know, I've been all over the world. I'm not from here. But people do not associate with one another in any kind of way. Any kind of way. And socially, religiously, what have you. And there's a comfort zone that the majority like about that. You know, the bottom line in terms of changing things, whether it's LaPon or, you know, Door County or Milwaukee, it's got to be an effort to diversify communities. People who live among people who look like them throughout the state. Parts of Wisconsin, there are no minorities. Already like this current guest, there may be one or two minorities. So they can talk all they want about the, you know, different organizations to try to rectify the problem. But if the apartheid thing overwhelms everything, you know. Mm-hmm. I have experienced, for instance, daily. I experienced daily. I've gone to a bar recently, waiting for a couple who happen to be white to have dinner together. Nice, nice, nice restaurant. I walk up to the bar, and the guy says, what do you want? You know, and I immediately...
Oh, I don't know why we lost our caller. Oh, I'm sorry, Jerry. For some reason, we had an issue with the phones, but we got your point. Jerry says that it's not just segregated in Wisconsin; it's practically apartheid, Sheree, and that there's no relationship between everybody lives their separate lives. What do you think?
I actually don't disagree with him on that. I think the issue to me here in Wisconsin is the small towns. There's so many small towns versus the urban centers. And so when you have so many small towns that there's really no diversity in those towns, and then you have the only image that they see are the urban centers, then they unconsciously, I would say, build an infrastructure that isn't welcoming to any minorities. You know, that's the issue that I have here, is that I have to travel 50 miles for hair products, which is ridiculous. It sounds like it shouldn't be that way, and I'm sure you can't imagine, you know, going to a shop and not being able to buy hair products, but that's my reality. That's my reality. And so he is correct about that, and there are times that it is overwhelming and very pressuring to feel like you always have to be the model citizen, because for WAPON, I'm representing almost every black person that they run into. So I have to be congenial. I have to be nice. I have to be accepting and welcome, because if I don't, any person that moves in after me may feel the wrath of that. So there's a big weight that I carry on my shoulders that people don't even realize here. Yeah. And it's something that they take for granted that I can never take for granted.
Well, it gives us a lot to think about. Sheree, thank you very much for joining our roundtable.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. Sheree Davis. She lives in WAPON. She works for an organization that supports individuals with intellectual disabilities. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with a group of African-American men and women who live in Wisconsin about what it is like for them to live in Wisconsin and what's standing in the way of better dialogue, a better relationship between African-Americans and whites in Wisconsin. Do you think that racism is still a problem? Do you think stereotypes still persist? We welcome your input, too. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, let's welcome in our next guest. Julian Bradley is the former chairman of the La Crosse Republican Party, and he is the GOP's vice chair for the 3rd Congressional District. And you are, Julian Bradley, a candidate for Secretary of State. Is that correct?
Hi, good morning, Joy. Yes, it is.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for joining us. You are active in Republican politics, something you didn't start out aiming for. What is your experience as an African-American in politics?
I'll tell you, I started out, my mom was a Democrat. So I grew up really believing that that's where I identified as well, as was with the Democratic Party. And then we talked about some more social issues, specifically life. And she told me that my pro-life stance made me sound like a Republican about 12 years ago. So I decided to look it up, and I found out that, indeed, I did line up much more with the Republican Party than the Democratic Party. And that was what, you know, started me in Republican politics. And I was always interested because my mom was very interested and very involved in politics. And it was interesting and a neat discovery for me personally, because you were just talking about stereotypes. There are so many stereotypes out there regarding the political parties and race, that it, for me personally, it was an awakening to find that it was the Republican Party that pushed for desegregation, and it was the Republican Party that was founded as the abolitionist movement and fought for women's suffrage and all of these things that I just wasn't aware of, and certainly not any of those things that fit within the stereotypes that are portrayed of the Republican Party.
Yeah. So, do you take any sort of flack for being an African American man who is in the Republican Party?
Nothing came up from any of my black friends until Barack Obama ran for president in 2008. Up until then, it was, okay, Julian's a Republican, that's okay. and then when I did not support then-Senator Obama, then I got some flack for it. And that's what got me, you know, starting to think about shattering stereotypes, which was the speaking tour I was on last year, where I talked about the rich history of the Republican Party and its involvement with the black community and with women, really, as well. Nothing from inside the party at all, which was kind of a relief. You know, again, I grew up in a Democratic household. So when I became a Republican, I thought, gee, I don't know. You know, you hear these stereotypes so much. It was kind of nerve-wracking going to my first meeting. And everybody was very cordial, and we were there just to talk about, you know, Republican politics. So it was a great experience. It's been continually a great experience these last 12 years.
Well, tell us a little bit about your personal experience in La Crosse, Wisconsin. What's it like for you?
Sure. Well, we moved here in 1992. I was 11 years old. I'm originally from Maryland. I was born in Baltimore. I was raised in a small town called Lexington Park. So there's quite a bit of diversity. And diversity wasn't something I was really familiar with until we moved here. In sixth grade, I went to Mount Calvary. It's a Lutheran school here in La Crosse. And I was the only black student in the school. So that was my first real introduction to really defining what diversity is. It was a little bit of a culture shock to me to be the only one. But in the last, 22 years, I've seen La Crosse grow by leaps and bounds, and it's been a very positive growth. There are a lot more minorities here in the area, and while the stereotypes continue to persist and exist, it's not as difficult, I don't believe, as it was. My niece, I have a niece that's also mixed. My mother was white, my father is black, and I have a niece that is mixed as well. She's biracial, and I see things are easier for her now that she's a high school student than they were for me when I was first here. So it's taking some time, but I'm seeing, as the next generation goes, that things are getting better. Progress is being made.
Well, that's positive. Are there any moments where you experience the microaggressions that we have been talking about with our other guests?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was, in case you weren't actually listening to them, the slights, the hidden racism.
Sure. There are things that happen. With my role being prominent, your last guest was talking about that too. She lives in Waupun, and she finds that she represents, you know, a lot of the black community because that's who they encounter. With my role being prominent in the La Crosse area, I try not to publicly talk about things that may have been negative that were a distant past, because I don't want any kids that would see that to say, well, this is what I'm going to experience. I'll be happy to talk about experiences one-on-one, because these are uncomfortable conversations that have to exist in order to eliminate these things. You know, people need to know these things happen, but I try not to allow the negativity or anything negative to hold me back, but rather to try to use that as a positive to drive me to, you know, spread a message that would help that and keep that from happening in the future.
Yeah. How would you improve the dialogue when it comes to, you know, race relations or racial issues?
Well, I think this is a great start. I think this is a fantastic start. It's, like I said, it's a very uncomfortable conversation, whether you're in the majority or the minority, because everybody's worried about offending everybody else. And, I think, you know, just being willing to sit and talk about it. I think parents being willing to talk about it with kids being willing to ask questions. I welcome any questions that come to me and say, you know, like your question, what was it like in La Crosse? You know, 1992 La Crosse, it was a culture shock for me, but now it's a totally different story. But I think having those conversations, being tolerant, and being willing to answer the questions, not talking down to anybody, those things are going to go a long way towards, you know, continuing to repair any trouble that's out there.
Let me go to Mike in Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Good morning. Two of my younger kids, I wanted to get them into a school which gave them an opportunity to learn in styles, like Gardner's book on, I don't know how many different styles of learning he proposed there were. And this school kind of specialized in that. So it was a Central City school. I live in the Central City as well, but we got them enrolled in there. And I would say out of 300-400 kids, maybe my kids were one or two of five white kids in the school. So anyway, you know, getting to know all the kids in their classrooms, and, you know, volunteering in the classroom and talking to the teachers and getting to know some of the families and stuff. All these kids were just outstanding, just lovable, sweet, smart, really talented in a lot of different areas. And then there were these statistics that were published in the last 10 years.
And Mike, I don't mean to cut you short. I'm so sorry, but we have two other guests, and I wanted Julian to respond to. Here, I guess he was surprised that there was such an educational achievement gap between African-Americans and whites. It wasn't the case in this school that he had his kids in, Julian. Any thoughts on that? I'm sorry, are you there, Julian?
Yes, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question for me?
Well, he was saying that he was surprised that there was such an achievement gap, or, you know, you hear these terrible, terrible reports, yet the school where he had sent his white children to, predominantly African American, these kids were really were doing great. I guess maybe thinking that we were hearing all bad news and not good news.
Well, it's unfortunate that and I think you nailed it there, that the things that come out most are the bad news stories. And I think a lot of this plays into the charter school conversation that's come up as well. I mean, when you think about it, every child deserves a good education. And we need to make sure that they get that. And when we talk about kids, like, I don't have any kids personally, but I've got nephews and nieces, I think all options need to be on the table so that we can make sure that these kids have that opportunity to be in an environment where they may be able to excel.
We'll leave
and
it
then
there.
Okay.
We have to move on. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Julian Bradley, former chair of the La Crosse Republican Party, living in La Crosse. We'll talk to two other guests in our roundtable before the end of the hour, and we'll welcome more of your questions and experiences as we talk about how we can improve the dialogue, how we can talk across racial and social lines. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. In light of so many reports condemning Wisconsin as the worst state in the nation for African American children, pointing out all the wide disparities in income and education and incarceration between blacks and whites in Wisconsin, we are following up on a conversation that occurred in Madison last month, an in-depth discussion about bridging the racial divide. And we thought that we would extend the conversation to the state as a whole. And we have invited a number of African American men and women living in Wisconsin to share with us their experiences and what they think stands in the way of a better dialogue. And our next guest is Victor Washington. He is living in Milwaukee. He works as a security patrol officer and is a chief petty officer in the Navy Reserves. Good morning, Victor.
Good morning, Joy.
Tell us about what it's like for you living in Milwaukee.
On a daily experience that I have, it's normal when I have interaction with people is usually, right in this day and age, is amicable. Occasionally, what I'll run into, and I really like how Gloria puts it, I'll run into these instances of microaggression. Case in point, if I have a conversation with someone white, and we can have a nice discussion about anything, it can include race, another white person may come along, and this same individual I'm speaking with will drop me off in mid-sentence and act like I'm not there anymore. Mm-hmm. I've run into that everywhere, in Wisconsin and other places as well. So that's, she coined it pretty well when you have instances of microaggression. Another one is sometimes I run into patronizing or condescending remarks. You know how knowledgeable I am. They'll say, well, Victor, you know a lot for a black guy.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I know, Victor, that you said your education and how well-informed you are about the news and politics has surprised people. And I know that I apparently, the first time you called into this program, made a remark along those lines. And I want to apologize, but apparently I was surprised about your knowledge about Greece.
Yes, and, you know, I forgive you, Joy.
Thank you.
That happens, and this is what I encounter. You know, ever since I've been 5 years old, I grew up watching National Geographic, Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. My mother and family provided me books. I love studying about other peoples and cultures. People are shocked when I know something about their ethnicity. I've been accused sometimes of being a CIA agent. Mm-hmm. So, but
why do you think it is that people know a lot for a black man? How do you wish people would react to you instead?
Just see me as a knowledgeable person, and I'm eager to learn. I'm eager to accept other people's cultures and learn about them. You don't have to bring up anything about race. Another thing that I found is patronizing, and I've run into this too, is sometimes people will say, I have black friends. And my thing is, all right, you got a friend. You don't have to tell me you have black friends, because when they do that, that sounds disingenuous. A friend is a friend. That's the way I see it.
Yeah. There was, though, some talk earlier in this hour that we need to not live such separate lives in Wisconsin, or for that matter, anywhere, that we, you know, it's whites socializing together and blacks socializing together, and not as much friendship among each other. Do you see that?
Yes, I do. You can see it in the break rooms and jobs. I've seen it in the armed forces, everywhere. It is true. What it is a comfort zone. You know, if people have the same political background, political views, eat the same foods, that happens. And I personally don't have a big problem with that. The only problem I have with it is if, you know, when ignorance comes forth. Yes. You know, there's some racial slurs and that kind of stuff. I have no problems with people segregating themselves because it is a comfort zone, and I understand it. Me, I don't do it at all because I'm a solitary person. I don't hang with anybody. I pick my own friends.
Well, what do you think it'll take for there to be a better connection, better conversation among people from different backgrounds? And I don't know, are you optimistic?
Yes, I am, and it's possible. Anything is humanly possible, and especially humanly possible. I'm Christian. Anything is humanly possible by God and Jesus. But we have to be honest with one another. Sit down. If you want to find out what it is about being a black American, sit down and talk with me, and I'll tell you what it's all about. And I'll have the same openness if they want to tell me what it's like to be a Ukrainian or Hmong or whoever. Sit down and talk to me. We'll have face-to-face dialogue. We'll learn about each other's culture. But it has to be initiative on both sides. And it has to be an initiative to do some background research on different ethnic groups. You have to take that personal initiative.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Hmong, we will be looking at the Hmong experience in Wisconsin next month. We're going to try to do these conversations each month, and we'll continue the conversation. I'll talk to you soon, Victor. Thanks a lot for being with us.
No problem. Anytime.
Victor Washington is an African-American man who lives in Milwaukee. And we are going to welcome in our next guest, our next and final guest during this hour, Daryl Mayfield. He is an instructor of business ethics, diverse cultures, and other courses at Upper Iowa University in Wausau. He is the owner of Bradley Mesh Consulting Group, and you've heard him as one of our guests on our Week in Review programs. Daryl, thanks very much for being with us.
Fantastic. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you told us that you approach race as a social construct. How do you think this changes how you experience race in your everyday life?
Prior to the end of the, or should say about the middle of the Enlightenment, there was no concept of the idea of race. That was a concept that was sociologically created. People say that someone is black or someone is white or Caucasian. These are not terms that can be proven biologically. There is no science behind them. It is simply a social construction. However, when we began to put faces on that social construct and to begin to make policy decisions and other decisions based around it, suddenly things get out of whack. I remember in my own life a one interesting situation. A colleague of mine who had been a city manager in a town also taught at the local college. He then accepted a position in another city, and that position teaching at the college came open. I remember the mayor that I worked for, we had talked about that, and he said that that other fellow was giving back to his community. Well, after he left, I was offered the position to teach at the college, and I did accept it. And the very same mayor said to me that I was moonlighting. On the one hand, the other guy, because he's of European descent, is giving back to his community. Mm-hmm. When I accept the job and I'm teaching, I'm moonlighting.
Yeah. Well,
these are things that I think happen as things get out of whack when we, as individuals and as a culture, accept a social construct whose job is, the social construct, its job is to simply make sure that we can identify in some way those in the society who shall have, who shall not have, who shall have access to having.
If race is a social construct, how should we talk about it?
Well, I think I'm fond of using Einstein's quote that we cannot solve the problems that we have today with the same thinking that created the problem. I think that we have to have a different vocabulary, a different lexicon for talking about the actual issue of ethnicity, in recognizing that when we talk about the social construct of race, one of the things that we like to believe or think is that everyone who fits into that has had the same experience. Barack Obama has not had the same experience that perhaps any 100,000 other Africans who are African descendants in America have had. He is not the United States' first black president. He's the first American president of African and European descent. That's for sure, and Kenyan descent at that. That we can prove. The only reason why we've been calling blacks or individuals from Africa Americans of or African Americans is because the slavery process took away any identification for enslaved Africans to be able to identify with not only their languages but their different cultures. All of them did not come from the same tribe nor from the same area.
Yeah. So I wish we had more time, but our last question.
Sure.
I don't know. Are you optimistic? Is this better understanding soon to come?
I don't know. It depends on leadership. We have had these moments. The Skip Gates moment more than 3 or 4 years ago was a moment that perhaps we could have had a significant discussion. It turned into just a bunch of guys drinking some beer at the White House, and so we missed that opportunity. Now we've got a second opportunity to be able to have that discussion with the Donald Sterling, Magic Johnson controversy, I think, that the media is trying to create. But that conversation it needs to be co-opted by folks like Dr. Louis Gates, by folks like Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, so that if we really want to have a discussion, if we really want to begin to resolve some of these issues, it needs to be done by individuals who are leaders, who can speak not only historically to what has and is happening, but can also give a voice for those who are also voiceless.
Well, we will talk to you again soon, too. Thank you very much for being with us.
Daryl
Mayfield is an instructor at the Upper Iowa University of Business Ethics, Diverse Cultures, and other courses. Well, thanks very much to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program, and to Robin Cherry for on-air production. And thank you for listening and joining in. We will continue this conversation looking at the Hmong experience in Wisconsin coming up next month. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.